Okay, Hazel Rounding, Shed KM. You need a cold beer, don't you, on a day like this? I might finish my Kirk first before I...
Cheers, anyway.
Cheers.
You're listening to Architecture Masters with me, Owen Wainhouse. On the programme this week is Hazel Rounding, director at award-winning practice Shed KM. In this week's podcast, we ask what it means to have a house style. We also talk about Shed KM's new style of house. We talk about opportunities in Croydon and regeneration in Liverpool. We ask why colour palettes matter and from where architects get their inspiration. Finally, we discuss the process of opening a new outpost for your practice. We talk retaining staff and maintaining an office culture. My guest this week is Hazel Rounding, director at Liverpool and London-based practice Shed KM. Perhaps unusually in the architectural profession, Hazel has spent almost her entire career forging a reputation at one architectural practice. With her undergraduate degree completed in London, Hazel moved to Liverpool to complete her architectural studies at John Moores University. She subsequently joined the then fledgling practice Shed KM in 1998, shortly after it had been spun out of the well-respected developer Urban Splash. She went on to become one of three day-to-day directors. After 15 years with the practice in Liverpool, Hazel led the opening of a new London office for Shed KM in 2013. Over a beer in the practice's new London studios, just a stone's throw from the Barbican, I started by asking Hazel how she came to London, then left, then came back again.
No, I did my degree down in London at South Bank. So originally I'm from Hull, from the other side of the country. And then I came down and did my degree down here. And then it was the, early 90s recession when I moved up to Liverpool, largely to follow the work, because that's where the Objective One funding was from Europe. So I, as a graduate, I followed the work there. And then in the last kind of 5 to 10 years, followed the work back down here. Yeah. Okay. So it's quite interesting from it. Exactly. Yeah.
And so Shed KM was a newish practice when you joined them.
Yeah, it was within the first year. And it was a merger really between King McAllister Architects and what was originally the in-house architectural base of Urban Splash. Right. And so it's as Urban Splash got really took on two really big jobs that they decided they needed to go external, and Shed KM was formed. So right. Within that first year is when I joined to help deliver those first two projects.
And do you remember what those projects were?
So that was Collegiate, which was a residential project, and Matchworks, which was commercial office space.
What sort of size was the practice then? What were you?
So really, I joined when there were the sort of three founding directors and one graduate, and then another one joined about 2 months before me, and then myself, and those three, me and those two others, went on to really take on the day-to-day running of the practice.
So there's three directors.
So there was three. So there was three founding directors, and then there was three that were in within the first year, basically, that right. helped to establish the firm.
And the other two are still there. Of the three
sorry,
of you.
It gets complicated.
Sorry, yeah. Of the three of you.
Of the three of us, yeah. We are now the ones that day-to-day run.
Running.
So okay. Basically, we restructured the practice and equalised the shareholding back in 2008.
Okay.
And then the three of us went on to take it on as a day-to-day business.
And all three of you are still?
All three of us are still, two in Liverpool and myself in between, really, and looking for new opportunities all the time, hence coming down to London 5 years ago.
And so you live in Liverpool, do you say?
I do, and I travel down generally for the sort of main part of the middle of the week, Tuesday to Thursday, in one or two journeys.
So you're how many now in the practice?
So the practice is now at about 30. 32 overall, about 12 in London and 20 in Liverpool. So we always grew, I suppose, back in 2000 and when times got really good, up to like 2006, 2007, we grew to about 24, 25. We never wanted to become a huge practice. Yeah. We always wanted to keep control of what we did. And we're now bigger than we've ever been, but split over two studios.
Okay.
And I think we're comfortable with being that size in two studios, so maybe going up to like 40, 50 altogether, but not really managing a huge team where you start to not know the names of people. And
right.
And
there's a kind of magic number, is there?
Yeah, and also I think fundamentally the directors are still involved in projects.
So you know what people are doing in the studio.
Yeah.
And people talk about a kind of a magic number, I guess, about 10 when they have to start thinking about hiring in someone to do marketing or someone to do PR.
Yeah, it starts to. I mean, it's different for different practices, and there's no doubt there's some practices out there that it suits them to be bigger. I think for what we want to deliver and what we feel architecture is about, the idea that you have a kind of maybe around a 1-10 ratio on the director and staff numbers kind of works.
How much of your work is your actual time is spent on kind of business development, on bids, and on kind of?
Yeah, I think over the last 5 years things have evolved quite a lot. I think since making the sort of move to become more of a national practice and coming down to London and opening an office down here, we now really have a director that runs the day-to-day business in London. A new director, and part of that evolution really, and that story continues. And then two of those original guys with myself run Liverpool day to day, and then I tend to do a sort of overview of everything. And I think that's what we've realised that we need in terms of strategising and making sure we're always kind of got our fingers in the right pies and a little bit ahead of the pack when it comes to dips and peaks in different parts of the industry.
I mean, the kind of the decision to come to London, I mean, that's been written about kind of in some of the architectural press and things, but that's principally giving some reassurance to the clients locally.
Yeah. I think we just got to a time where we felt we had something to offer to some London clients. And there's a lot of London practices that will try to operate in the regions, which I think is more difficult. And we'd tried London a number of years ago for one project, Scion Computers did a fit out, and
Scion Computers, I remember that.
Didn't quite, I mean, it worked for one project for us, but I think what we realised was to really make it happen as a second studio, it needed to be one of those kind of original in the first year directors that understood the ethos of the company moving forward, and one of those needed to come to London. And so we sort of retracted after that one project, and things were busy in the north, and we were quite happy, and we had a lot of repeat work. And then around 2011, I think we realised that we'd started to accumulate quite a few contacts in London. But for us to really give them confidence, we needed a team down here. And for us to really do what Shred KM do, which is the day-to-day relations with clients and being pretty much on the ground, we felt we needed to be here to do that. So we started showing a bit of interest in the London market, and we got onto two shortlists within the same month, with the same kind of maybe more well-known practices, AHMM, Make, one in Brighton and one in Croydon. So not operating in central London, but operating in those areas that we'd proven our ability to deliver in and gain value in. And we won both of those within the same month, which gave us enough of a lift to
open up and start. And so the people when you first opened the new practice, did you hire locally?
Originally we took very slow, steady steps, and I think that's because we said if we're going to do it, we need to do it properly, we need to make sure it's Shred KM through and through. So at first, you know, I came down a day a week, grew that to 2 days a week, and then one of our associates decided to come down to London. He had his family were in London, there was a lot of sense in him coming back home, if you like, and And from there, we ended up with two of our associates down here, and someone who'd been a part one in Liverpool decided they wanted to come back to Shed Cairn, but didn't want to go back to Liverpool. Right. Studied in London. We were like, "That's great."
Yeah,
so sort of within that first year, we were very much more than 50% of the people running the London office
knew
the company and the ethos of the company, which was very important to us.
Yeah. And there's obviously a number of practices, as you say, who have started in London and tried to expand out into the regions. People like Field and Clegg Bradley, there's a few other names
yep.
who have started outside London and moved
yep.
in. How's London different from working in Liverpool? I mean, a lot of Shed Cairn's early work and with Urban Splash is on historic, we might say historic buildings,
yep.
kind of industrial buildings.
Yep.
There's some of that
yeah,
in London.
I think a lot of our history and the way we cut our teeth really was on regeneration work and hard to deliver areas about increasing value, often from limited budgets. So I think to have sort of learnt the hard way in a way and come to London
right.
and suddenly have slightly higher budgets was
yeah.
was interesting. I think for us to be able to bring that value down to clients in the south was key, and in some ways that gave us a unique selling point in terms of what we brought down here. I think longer term, once you become fairly established in London, then the flip side is London's very competitive.
Yeah.
So it in some ways more competitive than the North once you've made that initial splash
yeah.
to get
yeah.
repeat business going.
I'm amazed there are some people I know who have always wanted to be a lawyer or have always wanted to be a doctor or yeah. How early
yeah.
on did you know you wanted to be an architect?
I wanted to be an architect from about the age of 12 or 13, and it's funny when I look back and think about it, I think that I was from a pretty working class family in Hull, in Yorkshire. I had lots of family members in the construction industry. And I suppose at school I was always, I always loved art and design, but quite liked the sciences as well. And it was at a time that if you told the careers advisor that you wanted to do something, when you mix those subjects together, they were all about women into engineering. And
right.
they told me I should be an engineer, and I just had a feeling that I think I was always aware of the built environment and I was always aware of this more social responsibility of architecture.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting. It was an RIBA leaflet that actually made me think, yes, this suits me.
Right.
This is the subject that I want to do. And I remember going back to my careers advisor and saying, no, I want to be an architect. And them saying, oh, it's too long a process. And it's male dominated.
Yeah.
And actually, the more they told me that I couldn't do it, the more I wanted to do it. Yeah.
Right.
So I feel incredibly lucky that at the age of 17, 18, when you look into these things, you still don't know yourself really. You don't know what you want to do. And I feel incredibly fortunate that I found a subject that suits me.
Right.
And I think that's what a lot of people don't find really. So for me, kind of that mixing of the arts with something that had a social responsibility was really key. Something that people said I couldn't do because I was female and it was too long a process made me want to do it more. And I ended up coming to London because I was also of the mindset that if I was going to leave home for university, I was going to do something big and I wasn't going to go down the road. So I came down to South Bank University in London, and did 3 years there. Graduated in the early 90s recession,
right.
mid 90s, and London was a terrible place then.
Yeah.
I managed to. I think there was 90 that started our course. There was
90.
Yeah, there was 30 odd that graduated. I think they did the 3 years
yeah.
consecutively, and I think three of us ended up in architecture jobs. Most ended up in bizarre jobs that Actually, a lot of talent was wasted, never found it back into architecture. And I was one of the lucky ones
and,
that...
And that was principally because the market wasn't there.
The market wasn't there.
Weren't
I mean,
jobs.
It was before emails and computers. I remember sitting in Hyde Park and writing 100 envelopes and licking 100 stamps and getting 10 replies, and you know, there was just nothing there. And I managed to get 3 months actually at Practice Waldman and Jim in North London, and then another 3 months Barker Shorten, and another contract with Arca Design out in Kensington, which is when I realised that, again, this suits me, it's what I want to do, but the market's not here. And so ended up picking up Building Design one day. They were actually advertising for a Part One, which you never saw. And it was a place that I'd never heard of, which was Birkenhead. And I ended up applying, thinking I'm going to do a second year out and actually do more than private houses in Kensington and Chelsea and find out another side of architecture, which is when I realised after the interview where Birkenhead was. And I moved up to the northwest because at the time European funding was pouring into the Merseyside region and gave me chance to see a very different side, which wasn't your private housing. It was more
the rich people.
It was more about true regeneration and renewing cities, right. And
which is a lot of the work that you've got.
Absolutely, yeah. So and at South Bank, it had been very much about my studies, you know, a lot of the kind of projects were plastic surgery clinics in Kuwait and things like that. And I don't know, maybe it was just my northern roots to start with that didn't suit me to be doing that. But I ended up working in Birkenhead for a further year and then doing my part two up in Liverpool at John Moores, which was very much about the city, and it was about renewing the Docklands. And interestingly, we've just done a bid for the site that I did my thesis on 20 years ago. And so found a very different way forward, and then found Shed at the end of my diploma course.
That's really, it's two interesting things there. I was talking to Carl Turner 2 weeks ago, who's also, I think, from Yorkshire, and moved to London. I mean, you mentioned a kind of family connection in the kind of construction industry, and Carl was talking about how that's had an impact. You know, often there's that maybe divide between architects not feeling comfortable on building sites, not feeling comfortable in the kind of construction. Do you think that's true, or do you think any kind of... I mean, I remember Carl saying, having worked on a building site as he's younger and having that appreciation for the work that, particularly on smaller schemes, that builders do and the risk they take on.
I think maybe, you know, I had more awareness of it than some. I wouldn't say that was necessarily encouraging. I mean, I do remember members of my own family saying, well, you can't be an architect because you're a woman. Or actually, you know, the women architects that we've dealt with are real trouble. You don't want to be one of those. But maybe that intrigued me more. I don't know. But certainly, I mean, I think things have changed so much now. You know, I do remember 20 years ago feeling as if I should keep a fake moustache in my site boots just to get a bit more respect when you go on a site, whereas now, you know, things are so different. And quite remarkably so, I think, in 20 years, you know.
Yeah, that's a fundamental.
And also schools of architecture, you know, there was, I think out of the 90, there was probably 7 females when I first enrolled at South Bank on that particular year. Now, as I understand it, it's very 50-50 in schools.
So we were talking earlier about the kind of process then of coming back down to London and opening a new office down here. I guess from a client's perspective, Liverpool is a cheaper place to employ people. I guess there's a thought possibly about outsourcing work, having a main office here and having work done kind of elsewhere. You've got architects here, you're working on jobs. Are the jobs that you do, are they split? Do you have people?
One of the main reasons for opening an office in London was because we had this client list and we wanted to service them in the way that we have traditionally, but B, because we wanted some longevity and certainty to the Shed KM studio as a whole. And you know, we really felt the pinch in 2008 and the consequences of the recession, and so for us we needed to widen our
diversify.
But and we had some really good architects in Liverpool, and we didn't feel in many respects it was right that you couldn't be a good architect and live in the region. So we were very much about keeping those people and finding a way to feed everyone. Yeah, and, you know, they might have a family in the north and young children, and why should they have to up sticks and move to London just to be an architect? So...
Particularly, I guess, when people, you know, kind of lots of London practices are working in, I don't know, Shanghai.
Absolutely.
Or in kind of, you know, why is geography
a problem? And, you know, technology means things are so different. Email, drawing transfer, and the perception actually of travel. You know, it's 2 hours Liverpool to London, so it's the best 2 hours of my week to get some desk time.
And sit down and, So
we opened London really with a view that we could sustain our Liverpool studio by still servicing clients in London. Right. And for the first couple of years, we were probably a third of our staff were in London, two-thirds in Liverpool, but a third of our work was in Liverpool and two-thirds in London. So it meant that half of Liverpool was working on London projects.
Right.
Not because it was necessarily about cheaper salaries in the north, but just about sustaining what we'd grown up to 2008 as an office of a certain size, and we didn't want to lose that kind of numbers up in Liverpool. And it's and we always said that we would grow London really in order that as an overall office we could have certainty and diversity across our portfolio. And really it's only in the last year, I would say, that we've now ended up where some people in London work on Liverpool projects, which is quite an interesting twist. And that's just as the uncertainty of Brexit has fallen in. And actually, I would say that has affected more of our London clients in terms of uncertainty, where there's a bit of a blind eye to it in many respects from some of the in Liverpool and Manchester. Right. And as more of a case of, well, let's just get on with things while we can.
Right. Again, so that diversity of having what was once a kind of giving you protection in London
First time we've seen it slightly flipped the other way. So
might come on to how much kind of international work Shed KM's done, you know, the move perhaps to London, is there a look for international work? But that kind of exchange rates and things, and how as a services industry is architecture stands to benefit from.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting concept. It's not necessarily something that's happened with us yet in terms of international work. We've done the odd ski villa or apartment. It was more when I was talking to other creative industries that where they're providing a service maybe to the States where there's the time zone can actually work for us and the exchange rate can work, then there's a kind of delivery day by day and looking at things the next night. And I'm not sure how easy it is to transfer that into architecture, especially our business where we like to be on the ground. And
that's a particular thing about Shed KM, is it?
It is, kind of yes, I would say so. I mean, there are obviously practices that export their work around the world. I wouldn't like to think it precludes us from doing a job somewhere. Yeah. Interesting one day, but we would probably want a team based there. There's no doubt as a service industry there that the exchange rate can actually help in some respects.
That's interesting. I've heard people talking about, particularly in China, looking at some of the big kind of brand name architects and how they've had to insist now for projects in China on local staff and having people there to ensure the quality of the building, and that if you're slapping your name on a building that you ensure what's delivered is the quality that you know, want people coming along and seeing a building that's
and also, you know, feeding a local workforce, I suppose. I mean, one of our founding directors is now in South Africa, and we have looked at possible collaborations in South Africa. And that's where the exchange rate works against you in many respects, because there's no point in having a back office in the UK when you can produce work cheaper in South Africa. But you know, I think, you know, there's always complications there anyway in terms of exporting resource.
Yeah. And with the two offices then, I mean, people, it's a very basic question really about how architects work on a project when they're not together, you know, how they decide who's working on what, and how two offices, it doesn't matter whether it's Liverpool or London really, but how architects work together apart.
Yeah, I mean, we've always made sure that we have the client serviced on the ground. That's the main thing. And then, you know, there are certain things that need to be done by someone close to that client, but then there are lots of aspects of putting a building together that, that don't necessarily have to be done in that one place. So as we resource things in the office, we more often than not look at the right personalities to work with clients and the right knowledge base, and then build a team behind them. And, you know, certainly Ruskin Square in Croydon, we had a team down here dealing with planning, dealing with the client side of things, but when it came to producing door schedules and technical drawings, there was no reason that that couldn't be done by some more experienced staff in Liverpool. And that relies heavily on good communication, which I'd like to think we are one big family that can communicate with one another, but also kind of data transfer as well. So we do have a kind of metronet system between the two offices, so we can work live on the server from one office to the next.
You were saying how some architects you might put in more client-facing roles.
Yeah.
I guess as a director of a firm, you're having to think about which architects you put on which jobs and how you move people around. Naturally, there must be a some of the staff you have must enjoy more of a client-facing part of their job, and others must, in you, I guess, as a director, you're more of a, perhaps the kind of public face of the firm here, you must enjoy or be good at, you know, that kind of client engagement.
Yeah, I think that in the early days of Shed, we never used to take an approach that, you know, somebody might be more, might their forte might be more technical or whatever. And we always used to make sure people had the whole experience, and probably were quite unique at the time in affording kind of the luxury, and maybe that was fees at the time and grants and the type of work we were doing, but had the luxury of taking a job all the way through the stages and learning from every stage and knowing things inside out. But I'd say that's one of the shifts as we've grown to a larger practice where you've got more mouths to feed and you need to be more efficient in what you do. And as people get older, I suppose everyone has the chance to do everything, but then you realise that people have got talent in certain areas or they've got enjoyment in certain areas. You know, like I probably do enjoy being out there and feeling like we're bringing the work in the first place and dealing with people face to face. You know, certainly we've got a technical director who would be quite open in telling you that he enjoys putting buildings together. Wants to put a building together. And I think as we've grown up as a practice, we've realised where key people sit. And we do tend to hold on to a lot of staff because I think most people do enjoy working for us. And therefore, as people mature, I suppose you made the point earlier about it's quite unique to be at a practice for 19 years and how do we achieve that? I would say even over the last 6 or 7 years, there's been some key personnel that I think are crucial to the firm moving forward. And we've almost engineered roles for them to stay without kind of squashing their career and without, you know, so they still feel that they are progressing in the company.
Right.
And we build the practice moving forward around the people.
Yeah.
You know, we're only as good as the people that are there. So we find an opportunity to allow them to really kind of grow within the field that interests them.
Right.
Try to make that a mutual benefit, I suppose. Yeah. You know, if somebody suddenly decides that, you know, they're more into master planning than anything else and we want to grow our placemaking side of the business, then let's engineer a role where everyone can be happy.
Yeah. But you also, I guess, have to engineer an environment where people feel comfortable about saying that, identifying that, being kind of self-aware enough to identify that and then to say that to you
and I think that does come with maybe a few more years behind you and a bit of maturity to know, well, I really I really buy into Shed Cam, I want to be a part of it, but this is what I think I can offer, and then we can have that open discussion. And I like to encourage that. I like to we have quarterly staff meetings where Liverpool and London get together. And I quite often like to put quite provocative diagrams on the wall because I want people to think, I want them to be thinking behind the scenes, well, how can I fit moving forward? And because everyone's ambitious, everyone wants to know what the next step is.
Yeah.
So encouraging people to do that can only be of benefit both ways.
And I guess particularly, you know, in, and maybe in London, there's the difference there that you know, other firms trying to poach staff and other firms trying to kind of pick up. I mean, to be aware of that is.
I mean, you know, Alex, who now day to day runs London as director, he'd been with us since his part one and then part two in Liverpool. He clearly ambitious, clearly understood what Shed Cairn was all about, and you know, had come to a point where he knew he needed to make a big career leap himself, and was keen to do that, and felt that he had to leave Liverpool to do that and come to London. So I was like, so why are you not doing that with Shed KM in London? So you know, it doesn't make sense to me if there's key individuals there that fit with the company that we don't grow with them.
And you mentioned there people who get Shed KM. I'm kind of interested in that.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? I guess you can kind of from some of the kind of architectural trade press and things, you can see that you can see a, even someone who's not an architect can see a style there and a kind of a colour palette and a kind of an ethos. But is that written down? Is that discussed? Is it just something that's an assumed?
It is
kind of
endlessly
collective?
Discussed. and we do endlessly discuss, you know, what is a style and have we got a style? And I think we've concluded over the years that it's not so much a style but a way of thinking that manifests itself in something that is recognisable as a Shed Cairn building. And ultimately that's because there's usually a clarity in thought that allows us to be quite simple in the way that we achieve something deliverable, use of colour, you know, it's bold, it's cheerful. But that inevitably comes through different hands within the practice, but a way of thinking. And we shouldn't forget when I've told you about the kind of three founding partners as well, Dave King, who is one of the founders, who is now don't even want to mention his age, but you know, he's not involved day to day in terms of running the business. He's retired as a director, but he still sits in the London studio every day because it's a vocation at the end of the day, and it's something that he loves, and he's been very much part of creating that style through the years. So although he's not actively involved as a director day in, day out, he does sit in the office, he does show people photographs, he shows part ones, books, and there's a sort of infiltration of that way of thinking.
And a kind of brand,
brand and a
guardian
brand,
almost.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've tried to write brand guidelines. We have something of some brand guidelines, but what we do have more than anything is 20 years worth of work now, and actually I think that's where we have been successful in the amount we've delivered, and we've never been about being paper architects. So when it comes to staff reviews or when it comes to new staff joining, we always show them where we came from, what it's all about. There's very early images of Concert Square in Liverpool when nobody went into cafe bars in the UK, and just, you know, let people know where it's come from, in the hope, I suppose, that they pick it up. And if they pick it up, they clearly get it and they run with it.
Yeah.
And if they don't, then, you know,
it's
inevitably never right for either party. But so it's not a forced way of, but there's a chance to kind of buy in or not.
Yeah. From a colour palette kind of idea and things, is that, I mean, that there's a bit of talk about Mondrian and some of the kind of Dutch kind of influences.
Yeah, I think we like, you know, there's no doubt we like our strong geometry. We've been influenced by the modernist movement. Primary colours, you know, sing. And yellow has become quite infamous when it comes to Shed Cairn work. And that's really derived from architects being notoriously bad at colour and working in black and white and shades of grey. And at some point thinking, we need to add colour. And Rogers does it all the time as well. You know, yellow is a fantastic colour that sits well with a grey palette.
That's fascinating.
So we always end up pushing yellow.
And clients, I guess, as they start looking at a practice, will react to what they've seen before and will.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because
not, really.
It almost becomes a bit of a joke that at some point yellow creeps into conversation and clients now go, oh, not Shed KM yellow. And then we go around the houses and sometimes we use completely different colours. But quite often,
them.
They'll be the ones that fall back to the yellow because they can see that it works in terms of that palette. And it's sunny and it's bright and it's nice with the architecture.
Yeah. So a fair amount of work in Croydon.
Yes.
Which I guess you've developed. You know, a lot in doing some stuff in the Olympic Park coming up in London. Abbey Woods, you know, they're...
Yeah, I think it says a lot about where we've come from and, yeah. and that value that we can bring again.
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily about coming to London and jumping straight into the capital. Yeah. I think in terms of our ambition, we'd like that chance one day. But it's about steps all the time and growing. And, you know, I always said years ago, without Fort Dunlop, we wouldn't be doing £50 million projects.
Yeah.
And when we came down to London, it was very much, as I said, on the back of a Brighton project and a Croydon project, and it was about making values work in an ambitious way. And it suited us, and, you know, I soon fell in love with Croydon. And it was funny because I was a student and lived in South London many years ago. And you have impressions of these areas, but suddenly Croydon for me was full of opportunity and in many ways had lots of similarities to Liverpool, actually.
Yeah, really changing.
Yeah. And so on the back of that, I suppose we've ended up looking at Eastwick and Sweetwater, looking to sort of draw on some of that Hackney Wick area, Abbey Wood, where Crossrail's coming through. So all about change, really, changing perceptions, regeneration, and in the north, you know, that work continues really around Salford, more recently North Shields. And it's very much about the ethos of the company as a whole, and our portfolio of work. And I suppose that's something we didn't really touch on with the two offices, or two studios, as I say, one office, two studios, that for us to work, that thread needs to continue across them. So although sort of a year ago we were very much had enough work in London for London-based people and enough work in Liverpool for Liverpool-based people, I was very keen to still have the cross-fertilisation of staff because without that you'll inevitably end up going in two slightly different directions because the markets dictate a slightly different approach. But it's vital that we keep that ethos running across, which is changing perceptions, adding value, bold, strong architecture.
And you're spending a huge amount of time travelling. I've always kind of slightly been interested in how much architects may be interested in just the idea of spending such a large amount of time travelling in the UK. Yeah. You know, trains are kind of famous for being delayed and things. That works, does it? You can.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with the travel because I think that, well, it's really good time, a desk time that you don't tend to get. But also, I'm a firm believer that architects can't be static.
Yeah.
You know, your ideas need to keep moving. And there is no doubt that the North and the South have slightly different approaches.
Yeah.
But if you can kind of glean knowledge and ways of working from both, it's the same as sort of travel on holidays and things.
Yeah.
I can...
Right. Slightly inspiring.
Yeah, I can never believe when some architects don't travel because...
Yeah.
Or take the opportunities to travel because it is what inspires you. It is what keeps your ideas fresh. And, you know, I sometimes feel like am I exhausting myself because I travel through work, but then on a weekend I just want to keep going because it's what keeps your mind active as much as anything.
So you're talking, I guess, maybe as we finish up about the things that inspire you and give kind of influence, some of the buildings maybe in London, maybe in Liverpool as well, that, you know, if someone listening was to be inspired by something, what would you point them in the direction of?
Okay, I'd say more lately, myself, I've been more challenged, enlightened by spaces between buildings, actually.
Right.
And I think moving on from seeing buildings in isolation, but how they knit together and, you know, that diversity I'm talking about in our work, how diverse cities can become. You know, just recently, I went to New York and had the most amazing 2 hours walking the length of the High Line and back again because it just seen people using cities.
Yeah.
You can't beat. In terms of our own work, it's for me, I think one of the key things is it's become more and more all about space.
Yeah.
So personally, maybe more and more inspired by space between buildings, but space in buildings as well. And, you know, one of our more famous projects recently has been House.
Yeah.
Which has been about being flexible and creating space and keeping the structure as simple as possible, so that in this country, historically, we've sold houses 1, 2, 3 bedroom, whereas in the commercial sector, we sell by the square meterage. Yeah. And so House is very much about selling space and carving that up to suit somebody's individual lifestyle in flexibility.
And that's quite a European approach, isn't
it?
It
is,
buy a house on the continent,
maybe
buy
that's the
60 square metres. And
I think maybe that is, again, that kind of European influence that will to kind of learn from other people and different cultures.
Yeah.
I mean, offices, again, as well, you know, we've always designed, really, that they can take 50 tenants or one tenant, and if the developer's lucky, they'll end up with one tenant. But it will always be a success because it will always be market-led, and it's about putting services and in the right place that you can carve space up. So I'm not really answering your question in terms of buildings that inspire.
We haven't talked about House yet, and I guess I'm interested in, I was talking to Peter about this idea of flexibility in buildings, and we've probably not, I might just ask you just to introduce House to say what we want.
House really started on the back of the last recession, when you know, our kind of long-term client Urban Splash was suddenly having to think differently about things, and we, as a sort of joint venture, really decided that it would be, we won at competition the opportunity to really think what family housing was all about moving forward, and you could say Urban Splash came out of that 90s recession with the loft apartment, and in late 2008. How do you reinvent yourself yet again?
From a recession. Right?
So there was a kind of will to look at what house builders were doing in terms of detached houses in cul-de-sacs and say, is this what the public really want, or is there something
all they're being offered? And,
absolutely. Yeah. And so House really started as a challenge to house building and a way of living, not modular necessarily, but about consumer choice. Yeah. So it gave the consumer more choice than what's the colour of your kitchen tiles.
Yeah.
It said, you know, you can live upstairs, downstairs, you can live open plan, you can carve up square meterage into any number of bedrooms. And through the process, we ended up realising that we were creating these volume spaces and there was an opportunity to go modular with it. Mm. So it's become very much kind of branded and out there in the press as modular housing, which it is, and it's far ahead of a lot of the talk on the market about modular construction because it's had 5 years R&D. But its main point really was that consumer choice and that ability to think about how you individually want to live your life.
I mean, looking at the housing market in London, you know, if you're looking to buy, there's not a lot of, you know, and you're looking to buy an apartment or a kind of even a, you know, terraced house, certainly in terms of new build, you can have a small bedroom or you can have a very small bedroom. Mm. You know, there is no opportunity for configuring or for, and that sort of innovative concept, was that part of the competition? Was that your response? Was that worked through with Urban Splash?
I think at the competition stage, we were very much about a terraced house, and we were very much about you fix a staircase and you fix a riser, and then there are other ways you can think about this. And it became a very joint client architect collaborative approach, really, that then almost went tri-party with the modular side coming into things. Okay. And it's the start, really. We've now developed Mansion House, which is an apartment type. We're looking at two more typologies for Urban Splash, but we're also, we've developed a typology for Capital and Centric. We've been looking at a build-to-rent product for Stanhope. So it, for us, it's the start of a whole catalogue. And I'd say that Shed, in the past, we've had a fascination with housing typologies. You know, the first modular we did was Moho, 12 years ago now, first private housing modular apartment scheme, where we challenged mortgage lenders to lend against products. And, you know, it's always finding the next thing, really.
Yeah.
Being hungry for a new idea.
Yeah. As a practice, you're doing a bit of placemaking, and certainly on some of these very big schemes, like Croydon and the Olympic Park and Abbey Wood.
Yeah.
A lot of that's about how your buildings create spaces around them.
Yeah. I think we're 20 years old this year, and we've just launched a new website, and with it our more recent tagline, really, which is innovation, architecture, placemaking. And maybe that's just maturing, changing our ways of thinking. I'd say it's just an evolution of the practice that we've realised more and more that it's not just about the building, it's about the innovation. That can be anything from technology through to the way you sort fee agreements out, the ways of thinking about residential market, etc. You know, the buildings are the most important thing. They sit in the middle of that tagline. Yeah. But they have to inform place. And I think what I have found interesting more and more being in London working with other architects is that shed do think of a little bit differently. And we find it really quite hard to, when you put a bid in, people come forward with CGIs of clad buildings, and we quite often don't know what the building looks like yet. We know what the figure ground needs to do to create the right spaces and to create the right building blocks that are efficient building blocks, and we know what the space inside the building needs to do in terms of good quality and value, but what everything looks like kind of comes a little bit later for us, because it is about how the space works both in and outside, rather than it's about creating a building that looks fantastic, but
that's probably most people's perception of architecture is what a building looks like, what you can see from the outside. That's the kind of the architecture, and you can take the architecture off and put different architecture on almost. And that's a complete...
But for us, you can renew a cladding package in 25 years, because sadly that's the kind that's of the guarantee life that you get these days on the life. But unless the building shape and the floor plate's right to start with, and the space that it leaves in between the next building is right, then it has no legacy moving forward. So in many respects we do think inside out about these things, but that's what we're about, really.
And then I guess what's next? You've now relatively new office in London. How much are you thinking ahead for the next kind of 5 years, the next 10 years as a practice? You've just had your 20th birthday as a practice.
It makes you start to feel old. And we've always been that we'd never want to be an aging practice. We always need to stay fresh. That's why for me it's about keeping the right people, evolving around those people. We've had moments, I suppose. The first 10 years was very much about that northern regeneration. We then survived the recession back in 2008. We reinvented ourselves. We came to London. I'd say the next 5 years for me are widening the kind of base of our work more. So more innovation, more placemaking. But fundamentally sustaining the growth that we felt. Not growing too quick, sustaining the ethos, but with the right projects and with the right clients that understand what we're trying to achieve. You know, it's worrying in some ways the amount of high-rise residential buildings that are just, you know, about how many apartments can you squeeze onto this site. I think it needs to have a bit more to it than that for us in terms of what we work on moving forward.
The next 5 years and the next 10.
Next five next, years, and before you know it, we'll be celebrating our 30th
birthday.
50th, wow.
Well, we'll perhaps maybe catch up before then. That's great. Thank you very much. That's
Thanks, Em.
Listening to Architecture Masters with me, Owen Wainhouse. My guest this week has been Hazel Rounding, Director at Shed KM. You can find out more about Shed KM and Hazel's work at architecturemasters.org. You can also send any questions, comments or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. I'm Owen Wainhouse, and thank you for listening.